Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jared Ball, who's an Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Morgan State University and the author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Ball.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And on this Martin Luther King Day, it's worth, I think, and important to address the pretty much what's in the news here today, given the president's speech last Friday, how much our secret police, our secret state, our surveillance state is alive and well, much more so than it was during Martin Luther King's day. But Martin Luther King, I think, stands as an example of the kind of abuse of a police state that was common in East Germany with the Stasi and very powerfully portrayed in that movie, The Lives of Others. Do you think that the experience of Martin Luther King has been forgotten in America?
Well, in some ways, it's not that it's just been forgotten. It's that it's never been told. We live in the United States, I think, with broadly speaking, with the, you know, within the most highly propagandized media environment that the world has ever seen. And part of that process, part of what has emerged as a result of that developing that as part of a process is a real historical amnesia. Or worse, never knowing, that many of us have never entered a state of really knowing, in this case, who Dr. King was, what his politics really were, particularly as they were evolving towards the end of his life. And then, of course, we don't know what the state's response to him was. So many in this country, as I've argued for some years now, I think Dr. King is the most known and least understood figure in human history, actually, maybe second only to the historical Jesus Christ. And as a result, so many people are aware of him by name and obviously associated with this I Have a Dream phrase, not even the full speech there, and don't really know where he went beyond that and what the state's response. So very few people are aware that at the end of his life, all the major media in this country, all the major political elites in this country, all of the civil rights elite leadership in this country had either distanced themselves or fully gone into attack mode against Dr. King. So that by the day that he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, Dr. King was under surveillance by the FBI and its counterintelligence program. He was under surveillance by military intelligence, by the CIA, by undercover Memphis police, and more. And all because of the stances that he was starting to take politically, anti-Vietnam, anti-war, anti-capitalism, non-aligned movement alignment, so to speak, pro-labor, anti-white supremacy. He had become an enormous critic of the black bourgeoisie and of white liberals in particular as not doing their part to advance the struggle. He was critical of the civil rights legislation that was being passed and the Voting Rights Act as being insufficient and not addressing, you know, all of the concerns that result from a structural inequality as a result primarily of the capitalist economy. And he was looking to develop strategies to really draw attention to and to strike at the heart of these issues. So he had become, by the end of his life, as even reported in the pages of the Washington Post, a threat to national security. And as we unfortunately saw, he was dealt with as such.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Ball, an Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Morgan State University and the author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. But just to give some context, Jared, to the April 4th assassination in Memphis in 1968 of Martin Luther King, he had previously been in Memphis and led a demonstration that turned violent, largely because of FBI provocateurs. And the FBI then put out fed to the media because Martin Luther King was whisked away from this demonstration. It was one of the lowest points in his life because here he was a champion of nonviolence leading a demonstration that ended up with windows being smashed and looting, etc. So he was whisked away out of this demonstration, and then the FBI then put out to the press that he ran like a rabbit, etc. And as you just pointed out, the surveillance of him was ubiquitous, and that's the whole point of what a police state and this police state mechanism can do to an individual. They have the ability to write their own script, and you are merely an actor in your own life if they control you in the way that they control Martin Luther King, surely.
Absolutely. And again, as others have tried to point out, as I've in some minimal way tried to point out, the surveillance that Dr. King suffered was merely an extension of the kinds of surveillance that people that preceded him in this liberation struggle have suffered, that people in all really oppressed conditions have suffered. Certainly in this country, since the advent of enslavement, African people have been under surveillance of all forms by the state and other friendly entities from the beginning. So this was merely his turn, so to speak, in taking that center stage as this actor, as you described, or at least with an attempt there to manipulate him, to manage his behavior, to control what ultimately would be his behavior. And this is why the FBI encouraged him through letter writing to kill himself. They threatened to expose his infidelity. They threatened to, as you said, to further this myth of him as a coward. And even as I said, in the pages of the most popular newspapers in this country, they were depicting him as someone who was, by the end of his life, losing control over the movement and succumbing to communists and Leninists and black powerites, and repositioning him as somebody who could not be taken seriously, who was now outside of the established acceptable civil rights leadership. And this is why they were saying after his anti-Vietnam speech, or his most famous one at Riverside Church in 1967, the popular press, the Washington Post and Time Magazine and Newsweek, described him as having lost his relevancy, as having lost his bearings, as having basically given a speech that Hanoi would have found suitable, and were looking to, again, to discredit him, to weaken the impact that he was actually having on the movement, which was taking, again, his part in a line or in a collective of people who had preceded him in this way to be critical of the economic system, to be critical of the militarism, to link the civil rights movement here to the human rights and liberation struggles of black and brown people all around the world. This was exactly what those in power had happily seen him not do earlier in his career and look to expand upon. And this is why I think it's also interesting, given the way Dr. King is depicted today, for people to realize or to learn about or investigate the ways in which, as some researchers before me have pointed out, that up until 1965, the popular press in this country loved Dr. King and loved, in particular, to use him as a counterposing figure to against people like Malcolm X and people like Robert Williams and people engaged in more aggressive and radical forms of political struggle. But by 1966, Dr. King had, through his own experiences in Chicago and elsewhere, begun to amend his policy, amend his political trajectory to adopt these more radical positions, and the press took suit in attacking him and looking to again do to others what do to King what had been done to others, that is to set him in opposition to other more acceptable forms of leadership, so that by the end he was quite well, literally in the sense of the balcony, but figuratively in the sense of popular media, left to stand alone and suffer the consequences of those positions. And since his assassination, while the conditions of black people have steadily declined rather than improved, the mythology has gone in quite the opposite direction, which has necessitated an attendant mythology of Dr. King as being someone who would have been happy with the progress, so-called, that we've made since his assassination, when I think it's quite obvious that the opposite is true.
And Jared Ball, recently the people who broke into the FBI office in Philadelphia, or outside of Philadelphia, that revealed the COINTELPRO operation, amongst many documents that they got from this FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania. That couple recently was surfaced on 60 Minutes in a book that's been written about them. That, of course, led to hearings of the Church Committee, which both brought about FBI reforms and CIA reforms in the form of the two oversight committees on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, etc. But I find it pretty extraordinary that as the sort of wheel turns, if you will, here we are talking about an NSA that has infinitely more capability than anybody had back in the Church Committee days and is not just surveilling African Americans, they're surveilling everybody. We're all caught up in this metadata as though we're all guilty until proven innocent.
Well, that's right. And the small point I've tried to make about that is that this is the logical conclusion of the incompleteness of a movement that was symbolized and in some cases led by Dr. King. So what we saw happening to King and many others in that movement and many people before that discovery in Media, Pennsylvania had been saying, look, there's something going on here. There's some sort of government involvement in disrupting our movements. And many of them were chastised for having even, you know, for even considering that such a thing was possible, only to discover that not only was it possible, that it was much more deeply involved and pervasive than anyone could have ever imagined. So just as the letter writing campaign looked to falsely describe King as someone who was a traitor to certain ideals of the movement, or someone who was engaged in all kinds of infidelity, cheating on Coretta, or as someone who, as the FBI in their own letter writing campaign, tried to convince King himself to kill himself. These kinds of endeavors have only been, not only were they more extensive than, you know, beyond Dr. King himself, but they've become far more pervasive and extended beyond the so-called political battlefield to, as you said, to incorporate all of us, even those of us who are not currently engaged in any sort of consciously political activism or struggle against the powers that be. But this is what is, of course, as I mentioned a moment ago, if we look at just what has not improved in terms of the conditions, not only of black people, but of working people and many other groups of people in this country and around the world, there would have to be an increased level of surveillance, because there is an increased level of oppression that is being delivered and meted out upon all of these different communities. So much more has to be done. And with the advances so-called in technology, why not put those to good use? Because it is predictable that people who are being oppressed will use the media technology available to them to struggle against that oppression. So why not use that technology, as has always been, to spy on, to limit and mitigate any of the efforts that those people in struggle might take up, or the people who might potentially take up should they even ever discover what is actually happening here. I think it's the logical conclusion that that's what we would see, and this is what I think is important about this kind of history. By the way, the good folks at the Freedom Archives, who developed a couple of years ago this wonderful documentary about the counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO 101, what this documentary points out in introducing people to this history is that what was done illegally by the FBI under that COINTELPRO is now perfectly legal under the Patriot Act, which has itself been extended and buttressed by the current president, Barack Obama. So what is being done, what Edward Snowden was looking to make known to more people that was actually done illegally at the time of Dr. King is now perfectly legal and that much more pervasive. And as you mentioned, has caught has caught all of us up in its nets.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Ball, an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University and the author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. Well, the fact that at the National Security Agency, those who do the work of surveilling foreign targets and domestic targets, apparently they, it's sort of an inside joke that they have a program called LoveInt. That's a play on the word SIGINT, which is an intelligence abbreviation for signals intelligence. And LoveInt involves NSA operatives like Snowden was, although he was a contractor, basically snooping into their girlfriends or their wives or their friends' computers and phones and faxes and emails and tweets and you name it, to find out whether they're cheating on each other or whatever. And that's the sort of inside joke. So when I learned about that, I thought to myself, well, if they have the ability to do that as a kind of prank, we already have the infrastructure laid down for us for a surveillance state, a police state. And so it all comes down to the idea that, as the president is basically trying to sell us as well, that we just have to trust. It's all about trust, that they'll do the right thing. They have the ability to do what the government did to Martin Luther King, but don't worry about it because we're going to do the right thing and we only care about foreign terrorists. Do you find that reassuring?
Well, not at all. I mean, if we just look at the conditions again, if we just use the conditions that people suffer as evidence of the will of the institutions that govern our lives, I think we'll see that that statement can't be taken seriously, that that perspective at least can't be taken seriously. So as I'm just looking here at the Economic Policy Institute website, a piece written by Algernon Alston about what has not happened since Dr. King's, since the March on Washington in 1963. Just a few points I think will easily challenge that perspective. That is that, in 1963, there was a concern at the March on Washington about the slum-like conditions that many black people had to suffer. And today, half of poor black children live in concentrated poverty. In the late 1960s, 76% of black children attended segregated schools. In 2010, 74% of black children attend mostly still segregated schools. And on it goes. The whether it's long-term unemployment, which is for black America the highest it's been since 1948, whether it's been the gap between how much white and black people are paid at their jobs, all of these things speak to, never mind mass incarceration, continued political imprisonment, and so many other things. If we just look at some of these key indicators and see just what has not improved, we can see very clearly that the apparatus, the structure that led to all the conditions that against which Dr. King sought to struggle, still exists today, and in some cases are actually worse. So if you're going to have those kinds of conditions and you want to prevent what was the quite natural response of the civil rights movement from ever happening again, or you want to weaken what has started to occur with the Occupy movement, or you want to weaken what would have what would extend from any number of forms of struggling liberation styled movements, labor movements, etc., you would have to increase your surveillance. You would have to increase the pervasiveness of your surveillance, and then of course create the mythology around it that it is, as you were saying, all for the good. And to the extent that this is successful, it will protect those in power from having to deal again with a movement that produced King. And I think it's always important to remember that it was a movement that produced Dr. King, not the other way around. And if we want more Dr. Kings, we have to reorganize a social political movement that will produce that kind of leadership. And that's exactly what the counterintelligence program papers in 1966 said specifically they wanted to do, prevent the rise of a black messiah. They said that they targeted Dr. King as a potential threat should he, as they said, forego his obedience to white liberal doctrine and nonviolence and embrace black nationalism. And as he began to evolve and radicalize his own politics, he became more of a threat. And this is exactly what we could expect to occur again today. And that's why I think that there are direct links to be made between the surveillance suffered by Dr. King and those involved in that kind of struggle then, and the kind of surveillance that we're seeing now that involves a surveillance of people not even consciously involved in any kind of particular political movement, but who are potential members of a threatening political movement, given the conditions that continue to worsen.
Well, it seems to me, though, Jared Ball, that in many ways what's happening in this country is a kind of atavistic reactionary effort to keep racism alive. And it's largely, I think, a tactic of the Republican Party, who are, as we speak, conducting a war on the poor. They've cut food stamps, they've cut unemployment benefits. Their friends on the Supreme Court, the five conservatives, recently struck down important provisions of the Voting Rights Act. The subtext that they send out to the endangered white man, the working class white men in this country who'd vote against their interests and vote for the Republican Party, all of those fears are stoked and stacked by the subtext of much of what is, in fact, the propaganda within the Republican Party. In other words, my sense is that poor white people and poor black people have much more in common than they realize, and that the tactic is to divide them as opposed to allow them to unite around a common goal. Now, that's not to say that African Americans are uniquely being targeted and punished in this country with mass incarceration of black men, which is extraordinary and appalling reality. But just to my point about racism being a weapon to divide as opposed to allow people to recognize how much they have in common, do you accept that thesis?
Well, to a certain extent, I do. But what I think is the beauty of Dr. King's analysis as it evolved is that he became, and this is what I think added to the level of what was his threat, was that he became extremely critical, not just of Republicans and white conservatives, but of the Democrats and white liberals. And this is something that I think is largely lost in this discussion of the role race plays in dividing people and allowing for a tiny minority to rule all of us. And that as Dr. King himself said, and this is why I always encourage people to go back and read his last book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, where he explains very clearly that it's the liberals that he is most offended by, that it is the white liberals, as he said, that walked off with the aggressors once they got past the surface level changes of an anti-segregation movement. But when it got to the real core issues of the economy, of distribution of wealth and goods and services, of the treatment of black people, of the consciousness of surrounding black self-love and black collective development, that's where he became. That's what I find it, partly at least, what is most compelling about revisiting his work, because it is today, it is the Democratic Party that is as much guilty and as much complicit in the lack of progress as anybody else. And it's easy to blame the Republicans, it's easy to blame the conservatives, but, just for instance, I mean, it was Bill Clinton that attacked welfare, that expanded the prison industrial complex, that expanded the military, and just as it's Obama that has expanded the military beyond that of even George Bush, that has extended the drone strike warfare, the militarization of the African continent with AFRICOM, that has given more more to Wall Street than any other president before him, that has denied in his public statements chastising black people the role of entrenched white supremacy, structural racism plays in denying black people the ability to sustain and develop and build a better lives and communities. So it's that I think is important to remember here as we reflect on Dr. King and where we are today, that as many others, as Malcolm X and Kwame Ture and others have pointed out, Dr. King, too, had become a vociferous critic of white liberals and, of course, the black bourgeoisie as not playing their role in this struggle. And he said, in fact, that white people had not something to the effect collectively psychologically organized themselves to deal with black people on a level of true equality. And I think that still plagues us today. So we'll get the symbolic political crumb of a Barack Obama. But when it comes to really addressing the structural inequalities that do specifically target black working people, we get very little of that. We get quite the opposite. We get calls from the black president to be better fathers and to return to our bootstrap mentality. The same Barack Obama who would tell African leaders, as he did in Ghana some years ago, that the problems they face have nothing to do with European colonialism and imperialism, but have everything to do with black corrupt leadership. This is the kind of thing that we get from the left that I think that Dr. King was calling for us to pay attention to and to struggle against, and I think needs a mighty struggle against today.
Well, Jared Bowler, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Ball, who's an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University and author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the political legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King.